Okay, thank you everybody. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm Jenny Lyon. I'm the current president of the Actuaries Institute, and I'd just like to welcome you all here today for the GI Glimpse, which is the third one that we've held. So it's great to see such a lovely turnout here, and I believe we also have quite a number of people on the webinar. So welcome everybody. The aim of today is really to let you as young general insurance actuaries take a glimpse into the opportunities and challenges of the current GI industry and think about those in the future. My background for much of my career has actually been around recruitment and in particular advising actuaries on their careers and helping them think about what it is that they want to do in the future. So for me, this is a really interesting kind of approach to take, particularly in the current world where things are changing so very rapidly and where we don't expect that people will be doing the job that you're doing today will still exist necessarily in 10 to 15 years. So you're going to need to be flexible and adaptable and already thinking about where the future is. One of my themes as president has also been to focus on young people. I see the role of counsellors very much preserving and sustaining the profession for the future, and the younger people in our profession really are our future. And so it's really fantastic to me to be able to be here today and talk to you and encourage you to think about where you think the profession should be going in the future. I have seen general insurance skills as particularly useful and transferable. And a number of years ago, a lot of people went into general insurance and life insurance was considered to be kind of the dead area. However, we're now seeing life insurance companies being interested in taking on people who've got general insurance skills because of the increased focus on data that we've got and the analytics that they want to do. So I think the skills that you're all learning at the moment are very transferable for the future, and encourage you, you know, to see today as ways of thinking about where they might take you. We'll now move on to the sponsor slide. So I would like to thank and acknowledge our sponsor, PwC. They're sponsoring Cleanery 2, and I appreciate their support of the seminar. If you're using social media, we'd invite you to follow the seminar on Twitter. Keep up to date with what's happening by using hashtag GIGlimpse2017. We also have an internet hotspot. Here's the password. Please turn your mobile phones off. I'm sure you're at least to silent. So I'd just now like to introduce our facilitator, Winley To. Winley is a principal at Taylor Fry and is responsible for the strategic management of the firm. She's held consulting roles in London, Sydney and New Zealand and has a wealth of experience advising on both long and short tail lines to corporates and government. Winley is currently the appointed actuary to several general insurers in Australia and New Zealand. She enjoys the collaborative aspects of her work with clients and the drawing together different disciplines to deliver successful business solutions. So welcome, Winley, and have a great morning. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jenny. It's great to see so many of you here today. I didn't expect such a big turnout, but it's fabulous. So it's a pleasure for me to facilitate today. When the Institute asked me whether I would do it, I immediately accepted. And I think it's just wonderful to be able to play a part in a seminar aimed at young people like yourselves who are just embarking on your careers in this industry. I've had over 20 years in this industry. I can say honestly that it's been one that's been immensely fulfilling and one that I feel lucky to have been in for all this time. It's been, at one, intellectually stimulating. It's continually evolving and innovating. It's exciting. It's always challenging. It's given me a range of skill sets, including, you know, negotiating, leading, mentoring, and so forth, and taking me all over the world. So it's very exciting that today you'll get a glimpse of the many different facets of general insurance and hopefully, you know, the various directions that you can take in your own career. So to start with, I'll introduce you to the first talk. So actuaries, it's entitled Actuarial Career and Skills. So actuaries are well known to have strong intellectual, mathematical, and problem-solving skills. This is known as the hard skills. Learning how to supplement these hard skills with soft skills will provide any aspiring actuary with considerable advantage in their career. So this keynote session with Elaine will look at the importance of soft skills and will provide a different perspective on career growth. So at the end of this session, it'll be a Q&A segment, and a microphone will be passed around. So please raise your hand and I'll point at you to ask questions. Also, you'll be sent an SMS asking for feedback at the start of the Q&A. So please follow the link and have your say. So Elaine is a fellow of the Actuaries Institute and a professional non-executive director with three current board roles for Zurich Insurance, the ARPC, which provides terrorism insurance, the MABE, which provides CTP in Tasmania, and she's also on risk committees, reinsurance committees, and she chairs the audit committee of the MABE. Prior roles include being a partner of Deloitte for 6 years and a director of KPMG for 5 years, where she carried out appointed actuary roles as well as a wide range of other assignments. She's also a member of the Professional Standards Committee and a sessional lecturer at UNSW. So I invite Elaine.
Thank you, Winley, for that very kind introduction. Very similar to Winley, whenever the Institute asks me to do anything, I say yes. So I'm here today. This session has been billed as that I will talk about the importance of soft skills in adding value to hard skills and provide a different perspective on career growth, sharing my personal career experience with participants. So I have tried to do that. But I just want to say to start with that when I started work, I never expected that I would be speaking to audiences about my career journey, but I've now done this a number of times. I thought it would be useful to focus on aspects of my career that contributed to where I am now, even though I may not have realised it at the time. I thought it would be really important to talk about soft skills, and I realised what a very topical topic it is at the moment. As a couple of weeks ago in the Sydney Morning Herald, Anne Summers wrote an article headed, "Australia needs to get soft to regain global influence." The article mentions how soft power is the ability to influence others to achieve the outcome you want. Today we are going to talk about my background, the importance of soft skills and how to master them in your actuarial career, making the transition from a technical role to one that is more influential, experience in boardrooms and being on a board, the value of networks, and balancing work and the rest of your life. So with regards to my background, I have been in the insurance industry for more than 20 years, similarly to Winley. And I made the transition from appointed actuary to non-executive director 4 years ago. But I do have quite a varied background in that I started with an honours degree from the University of Sydney in mathematical statistics, looking at a career in banking with no thought of an actuarial career or the insurance industry. That is probably very different to the background for most of you young people who completed an undergraduate actuarial degree, I'm assuming, so have been focused on actuarial from the start. This also means, though, that your degree was not as, this means that your degree wasn't as varied as mine, but you knew a lot more about actuarial techniques when you started work compared to when I did. By pure chance, after meeting a professional colleague of John Trowbridge's, I started working for Trowbridge Tillinghast, a global actuarial consulting firm in their general insurance group. I quickly realised that I would better progress my career in actuarial work by becoming qualified and decided to start taking the actuarial exams. I very much enjoyed actuarial work. Tillinghast called themselves a colony of artists, and I worked there for 5 years. I mainly worked in technical roles, for example, assisting the New South Wales government with privatising CTP, but also consulting type roles, such as a new collection of insurance statistics. I now realise how such exposure to these differing assignments at a young age was already developing my analytical as well as consulting skills. I worked with star actuaries, including John Trowbridge and Jeff Atkins, who really inspired me. This is where I come up with my first piece of career advice. Work with great people who inspire you along the way, and that is still my best piece of career advice. Don't agonise about which direction to choose. In the end, it won't matter. If you see an opportunity to work with great people, take it. If you work with talented people around you, then no matter what your role, you will learn valuable lessons. Amazingly, a successful career seems to follow. I then spent a number of years doing contract work for actuaries in the industry, which gave me the flexibility I was seeking while I was completing my fellowship qualification, getting married and having children. While I was raising small children, this work also gave me insights into other industries, since I undertook assignments in life insurance, general insurance, banking, investments, and superannuation, and reinsurance. The sorts of assignments, I just want to give you a few examples. In general insurance, I was doing a lot of CTP work for motor vehicle bodily injury and workers' comp work. In life insurance, mortality and trauma, actual experience compared to expected. Banking, replicating a line of credit simulator, superannuation, allocating share value to fund members in accordance with trustees and trustees' resolutions. So you can just see it was a variety of work, and now that I look back on it, that variety of work was actually invaluable to my experience. I think one makes connections between industries that has parallels to being a non-executive director. As a professional director, one is able to really look at things, connections between industries, and provide insights from an overview of the whole industry. And you can kind of see through the noise of any particular company. And that's the value of having a non-executive director that's on, I think, a number of different companies, company boards. And you really find relevant issues to discuss. Also, as a contractor, I focused on the assignment in hand until it was complete. Then inevitably, I would be asked to stay on for other assignments, which I usually did, until finally, when, for example, when working on quotes for a reinsurer, I had a baby due to arrive the next day and I really had to go. Then we got to the turn of the century and the demise of general insurance giant HIH. I mention this because it had a significant impact on the general insurance industry, even though it probably happened before any of you could remember. And it serves as important background for any non-executive director in the general insurance industry on what management must not do and what the board must not approve. For example, management of HIH did focus on premium income without sharp attention to the forthcoming cost of claims. Also, management of HIH took advantage of opportunities around the world without necessarily incorporating strong governance or any analytics. I feel very fortunate that my first directorship included working with a chairman who'd been in the general insurance industry for 50 years, and he had really seen it all. The background he had was absolutely invaluable in contributing to our boardroom discussions. The demise of HIH also accelerated our regulator, APRA, into introducing the appointed actuary role for general insurers. I carried out appointed actuary and reviewing actuary roles for the next 11 years. Although these are traditional actuarial roles in a traditional insurance field, one advises the board on a wide range of topics, particularly in the financial condition report, including risk management, profitability, and capital management. These are important topics which feature in my board meetings today, even though I'm now on the other side of the boardroom table. I think presenting to boards develops important expertise, which contributes to one day being a skillful non-executive director. I originally worked for KPMG when they asked me to come in as a contractor to assist with their liquidation work for HIH. They subsequently asked me to join them to take on appointed actuary roles. And I felt it was the right time, as my children were growing up and there were exciting things happening in the general insurance industry. Once I joined KPMG, I started working with accountants a lot. I hadn't really done that before, and it's really valuable. My network became much wider. And now it is more than 10 years later since I worked with some of those accountants, and I still come across them in the industry. And the history you have of sharing, working together is actually very, very powerful. I also took on a self-insurance actuary role for Australia Post and became a Singapore-appointed actuary. In fact, the Monetary Authority of Singapore introduced the appointed actuary regime before APRA. After 5 years at KPMG, I joined Deloitte as a partner. During my time at Deloitte, I worked on assignments in Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Singapore, and PNG. Working in other countries gives you important context, I think, and you can bring good ideas from one country and one assignment to the next. Deloitte also had a strong focus on the collegiate nature of the partnership and I learned a lot from working with partners in other divisions of the firm. We co-authored the annual General Insurance Survey to identify and analyse key market trends to provide an industry benchmark in capital strength, revenue and profit outlook by product line, using information obtained from survey respondents. And this gave me additional insights into the general insurance industry. And you're going to be hearing later on today some of those insights for your use in your work from Kevin Gomes. That's my understanding. Even now, I can see how this deep historic knowledge finds its way into boardroom conversations. As a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries, I have been on lots and lots of institute committees and working groups and task forces. As I was saying before, I always say yes to the institute. But I think that being on working committees is very valuable practice for board meetings, as things you really for kind of four reasons. One is you work in a volunteer capacity, which is a great way of giving back to the industry or profession. Two, there is an agenda and specific topics to be discussed. Three, you are surrounded by intelligent, knowledgeable people with different viewpoints. Four, you are seeking to influence the outcome, but are surprised by the clever thoughts around the table. Sometimes I attend a meeting, initially holding one view, and others in the meeting persuade me to change my view, and then I think what a valuable discussion that was. I want to mention one institute working group I was on when we needed to update our actuarial professional standards to allow for the appointed actuary regime coming in for general insurance. We worked with APRA to align the prudential and professional standards so that they didn't conflict. Particularly, we were trying to encourage APRA to set the rules for the insurers and we would write the standards for the actuaries, rather than APRA setting rules for both the companies and the actuaries. I think we achieved this to a large extent and formed a basis for alignment between APRA and the Institute going forward. And today, there are actuaries in Basel, Switzerland, working on alignment between international actuarial standards and prudential standards. I was speaking with one of them about a year ago, who worked on our standards in Australia, and he said that they are following on an international level the exact process we carried out in Australia. So Australia really led the way. You can see that's a map of the real world. Australia's at the top. I realise that my experience of working with the regulator contributes to my boardroom discussions, as APRA is a key stakeholder of any insurer. It is definitely true that sometimes you don't realise the true value of an experience until much later when you use that skill in a different capacity. In making the transition from a technical role to becoming a non-executive director or a more senior role, one's outlook significantly changes. The non-executive director role is a wide one, since topics arising at our board meetings can cover every aspect of the company. If you have a variety of experience in your background, you'll be more likely to grasp the business implications of the topics discussed at board level. If you have significant expertise in fixing problems, you'll be more likely to seek solutions rather than apportioning blame, and that's a valuable attribute. If you have credentials in working well with a team, you'll be well placed as a non-executive director, as the role of the board is a member of the team. I made the decision to move my career in a different direction when I had been in my partner role at Deloitte for 6 years. I spoke with the then CFO of Deloitte, Matthew Broadfoot, and he was very supportive of partners transitioning into non-executive director roles. After I announced my retirement from the partnership within Deloitte, I attended a 5-day director course through the Australian Institute of Company Directors. I have to say that undertaking this 5-day director course was great preparation in giving me an initial overview. In the course, we covered topics such as the duty of directors, strategy, risk, financials, legal responsibilities, the role of the board, and board decision making. We had a different presenter each day, and they each had 3 to 4 non-executive director roles, which kept them full-time busy. They had roles in a number of different industries to avoid conflicts, and I noted that a well-rounded board career usually seems to have one not-for-profit board. Once you have completed the course, you can take a subsequent exam and assignment which gives you a directorship qualification, a graduate of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. And after being a director for 5 years, I could apply for a fellowship, which is an FAICD, which means I could be 2 fellows, a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and a fellow of the Institute of Company Directors. I have to tell you two stories on the ARCD course. One is one of our presenters was talking about the fact that there are three kinds of boards: structural, behavioural, and value-adding. And the structural board is very much around looking at the skills of each of the director, making sure the structure is kind of what you need. The behavioural is more around the fact that boards, you want robust discussion around the boardroom table, but in the end, everyone needs to come together to make a decision. So it's kind of those behavioural aspects, which is kind of more the soft skills approach. And the third category is the value-adding board. And in fact, the presenter who talked to us about the fact that every director on the board should be value-adding says that he only joins boards where he feels he can add value in a particular thing. And once he's added that value, if it takes 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, then he steps off the board because he feels like he's not adding as much value as he wants to, and he steps on another one where he feels he can add that, like a kind of 100% value. So that's another way of constructing a board, kind of a value-adding board, but that's one that's going to be more, there's going to be more transition in the directors. So it's just interesting to hear about those three approaches. I mean, all boards have renewal policies, but you can see how with those three different ways of creating a board, that's going to vary as well. And my other story is around when we're doing the half day on risk. we were put into groups, and our presenter wanted us to think about in each group how likely we were to participate in dangerous sports. And I think they gave us a list of sports, and we had to make decisions as a group. And so our group sort of looked at these sports and thought, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll score each of them. You know, we gave one sport a one a five, one a seven, you know, to try and sort of see. And so we'd be able to come to a decision about which sports we'd participate in. And she came around looking at what we were doing. And as soon as she saw us doing the scoring, she said, well done, you've created a risk framework. You can go home now. So that was exactly the sort of thing that we needed to do. After I attended the ARCD course, I spoke with my clients and colleagues in the general insurance industry around my plans. I was very fortunate to very quickly receive two invitations to join general insurance company boards, of which, owing to conflicts, I could only accept one. Looking back, I think that the important thing was that these clients and colleagues knew me. They'd seen me within the general insurance industry over the years, presenting at conferences, attending industry meetings, and chairing seminars. Also, I'd been a media spokesperson for Deloitte on the topic of natural disasters post the Japanese tsunami in 2011. People thought that other partners I did a lot of media interviews at that time. And from that experience, I learnt the art of explaining technical work and analysis to non-technical people. And reporters are particularly non-technical. So that was important development in my soft skills, working with non-technical people, because you really can't be too technical because they just can't follow you. So that's just really doing some of those things is really important, rather than just thinking about them, actually doing them and explaining things to non-technical people, I think is very important development. Anyway, I think people thought that other partners at Deloitte would get me a board director role, but that was not the case. Just to let you know, people seeking non-executive directors for their board need to know you. So your own network is very important. Over the next couple of years, I was invited to join two more boards, so that my current non-executive director roles are the ones that Winley was mentioning, Zurich Insurance, MARB and ARPC. So just to give you a little more detail on Zurich. So it's a private company listed in Switzerland. I'm on the subsidiary board in Australia and also on the Risk Compliance and Audit Committee, as well as the Reinsurance Committee. But I want to tell you, I recently returned from a meeting in Switzerland that was in May, held for the independent directors for Zurich insurance subsidiaries around the world. And our new global CEO, Mario Greco, addressed us and had a 45-minute Q&A session with us directors. And it was really interesting to hear these points of view from around the world. But one story I want to tell you was that Mario was letting us know how he went about developing company strategy. So he's only been in the role for a year. So he came into the role, and what he did to develop the company strategy was he developed an international team. And the way he did that is he invited every employee in the world to apply. They then whittled it down from 1,000 to 200. Then he Skype interviewed them to whittle it down to 20. And it, in the end, this team was created from all levels in the company, from the very, very newest employees, the frontline youngest employees, to really experienced people. And they formed company strategy using the simultaneous top-down and bottom-up approach. I'm sure the young people in this team demonstrated some very good persuasive skills, soft skills in the interview to make the strategy team. My second board, the RPC, as Wendy mentioned, is around protecting Australia against losses caused by terrorist attacks. And obviously we've had terrorists getting a plane, you know, building a bomb for an airplane in the last couple of days. So it's, you know, it's something that the threat of it is around us, and we all really need to work together to try to minimise the threat. And on that board, I'm also on the audit. I'm on audit committees for all of my boards. The MIRB is where the company manages CTP in Australia, in Tasmania. So there it's interesting because in Tasmania, the government actually underwrites CTP. So it's different to New South Wales, where the government manages it and controls it, but licenses authorised general insurers to underwrite it. Whereas in Tasmania, the government themselves underwrite the scheme. So it's a monopoly scheme. And they've really had pretty much the same benefit structure, I think, since 1972. So it's really a great scheme. The benefit structure hasn't changed much at all. It's, I think it's got the lowest premiums in Australia, and it's got great benefits. So it's a very, very well thought of scheme. And there I chair the audit committee, and I do have to say it's been a step up for me because it requires more responsibility and more time. In fact, we're signing off the accounts next week. And also the opportunity to be more influential and to work very closely with the chair of the board. For my sins, I'm also the president of the Redlands Parents Association at my daughter's school, and I'm a sessional lecturer, as Willie mentioned, at University of New South Wales. So being on three boards gives me the opportunity to work with three different chairs, and that's a, you know, a great experience because I learn different skills from all of them. I feel privileged to have worked with some wonderful directors. It also allows me to bring non-confidential insights from one to the other. This year, it just so happened that each of my boards had a board member rotating off, so I had lots of phone calls from colleagues interested in these roles. Being on three boards also allows me to compare the conversations around strategy and risk culture. I always think of strategy as the key topic for the board, and risk culture is a key topic for the audit committee. That's kind of the way, or audit and risk committee, that's kind of the way I always think of it. But I thought it would be interesting to talk about some of the characteristics of value-adding boardroom discussions. Creating a fine balance between challenging and supporting management, balancing the big picture with attention to detail. See, some of these things are important for me, but they're important for you in all of your jobs too. Balancing pursuit of profit and or company goals with risk management. So you can see how some of the things that I'm seeking to do in my role, you can start to do right now in your roles because they're so, so similar. It's just important to think of these things. Think of balancing the big picture and the detail. So when you're in a technical role, of course you're looking at the detail, but think about the big picture and think about explaining the big picture to others, to non-technical people. That's how you start to develop your soft skills, I think. It's all about balancing risk and opportunity, and this should be summarised in a risk appetite statement from which company strategy is developed. So you can see that's one of my... there's always some things we feel really strongly about. That's what I feel really strongly about. The balancing risk and opportunity needs to be summarised in a risk appetite statement. It shouldn't be something that just gets written and then put in a drawer. And that's from that you develop company strategy and risk management framework. So to me, they all tie together. And I think so often companies have one over here and one over here and they just don't tie them all together. I attended a recent session by the Auditor General in Tasmania, and one of our presenters, they had a session in Tasmania for all the chairs of Tasmanian government audit committees, and since I was the chair, I went along to that. And one of the presenters mentioned the opportunity, the importance of clarity of message. I couldn't agree more. I love that. Clarity of message to improve risk culture in organisations. Risk appetite and tolerance is the responsibility of the board, and they should be really, really clear, and they need to cascade down to monitoring results delivered by the frontline people. Frontline, to me, frontline people are key. They bring in the revenue, they pay the claims. We can't give them confusing, complicated messages about risk management. A recent example is CommInsure, where it seemed risk management wasn't where it needed to be. When stories about denied claims reached the media, CommInsure suffered significant reputational damage. And reputation risk is one of the key risks shown in any company's risk appetite. My top scoring board papers, I am going to do this because I've got 10 things that I think should be in board papers. And so I'm going to share this with you because even though you may not be developing papers to present to boards, you still might be developing reports or papers to present to your manager. And I'm sure if you followed some of these suggestions, you know, if we start with the grassroots, if everyone's starting to do beautiful papers, finally it's going to filter up to the top. So my first thing is paper on time. My second thing is key implications need to be clearly stated up the front. And with that is what's, and if you can't think of what the key implications are when you've done some numeric work, think about what surprised you when you were doing your work. What did you discover when you were doing the analysis? Those are probably the key things that management or the board want to find out from you. Number three, context provided. The paper doesn't dive immediately into the topic of consideration without making the context clear. Concise wording. Any wording that does not contribute to the background or proposal is eliminated. Precise wording. No inaccurate statements, which would need to be clarified during the board meeting. Definitions, if needed, abbreviations clear, written in full the first mention, showing abbreviations in brackets. Tables of results. I mean, this is a classic actuarial comment. Tables of results showing row and column totals. Comparison to last time. Comparison to expected. Graph showing a total column. Unless the detail is important for board decisions, the breakdown, the detail should be in the appendix. The breakdown needs to add to total. You would not believe how often the breakdown doesn't add to the total. So some of these, and if you, you know, if your table shows row column totals or percentages, it's just so much quicker for people looking at your table to see what the implications are. Number eight, comments beneath the tables and graphs need to reflect insights rather than simply, for example, saying item three is the largest, because we can all see that. Clear subdivisions of data, you know, not less than 5, less than 10, less than 15, you know, but clear, 0 to 4, 5 to 9, assuming data's discrete and, you know, unless it's truly cumulative. Attention paid to punctuation, spelling, grammar. I believe that if these principles are followed, board papers and any papers you write for management are much clearer, and therefore there's a much better opportunity for the board or management to add value or your paper to be valuable. When we think about balancing work with the rest of your life, we usually think about women, which is probably natural as women bear the children. But it's important for men too, to balance work with other important things in their lives. It's important to eat, sleep and exercise well, not every day, but mostly. And to balance your time at work with time and other interests, also not every day, but mostly. And I practice what I preach because, for example, I've run the City to Surf every year for 30 years. The only 2 years I missed is when I was expecting my two children, and I'm running it on Sunday. I probably started running it before most of you were born, and my time has only deteriorated by 15 minutes. My best ever is 62 minutes, and I did 77 minutes last year. So it just shows, try to balance things. But I do believe the main challenge for those in senior executive positions is the long hours. I think women and men are highly capable of meeting the expectations of these senior roles. But women in particular, you know, really, really want to spend time with their children and they want to have significant interaction after work. And electronic communication allows more flexibility for women, but it can also mean that you never really take a break from work. Women with young children particularly find it hard to be away from them all day and relish the opportunity to spend quality time with them at home without the distraction of unimportant emails that could really have waited until the morning. And I've come across men who have stepped away from senior roles when they felt their work-life balance has been too impacted. Companies do realise the value of having talented people in senior roles, but they need to make it work. The business should be focusing on the quality of hours rather than the quantity. And unless it's an emergency, I think those early morning and late evening meetings just don't make sense. Although my statutory actuary roles were quite traditional, there are a wide variety of technical roles within organisations. The value of these technical roles must not be underestimated, as they provide valuable instincts for boardroom discussions. For example, as I mentioned in my board paper top 10, actuarial skills and disciplines such as comparing actual to expected, actual to last time, and analysing attribution of profit to source are useful in all aspects of business. And it's interesting because that attribution of profits to source, I really learned that in my life insurance course when I did it through the Institute. It wasn't really such a topical topic in general insurance. It might be now, but it was interesting how doing the, if you work in the different areas, you do pick up things that are really important in one area that can be useful in another. So those are actual to expected is really important. Actually, you know, if I see the number's going to be 62, well, what was it last year? What would it be if we didn't do that? So you'd be surprised how often I see boardroom papers that just give the answer rather than some analysis showing what it was last year, what we expected, and how the results break down. These are basic disciplines which should always be on display in the paper, as well as the key implications of the business. In summary, I think that technical roles can prepare you to be a non-executive director because it's all about asking the right questions and providing value-adding insights. So key soft skills. So I kind of thought about what are key soft skills that I think should be on display, or key soft skills that are useful for you to pick up through the years. So my number one was listen. You pick up a lot of information about what's important in your industry and what's important to others. Catch the eye of the leader. Think about how to state your contribution. Make a clear statement. Be willing to change approach after hearing thoughts of others. Always respond to and follow up emails, even if you just say thanks, that was very interesting. Always thank people for meeting with you. This gives you an opportunity to refresh what was said in their mind. My tips on presentations are when giving presentations, it's best not to write everything on the slide you are going to say. Otherwise, people reading at the same time as listening to you and they're just not quite as effective. I also want to talk about the value of networks. Don't disregard your own network, because even if people in your network are not seeking the role that you're seeking, they often know people who are. The seminars run by organisations such as the Actuaries Institute, ANZIF, APRA, and the Insurance Institute are also an opportunity to extend your network beyond your work colleagues. For example, earlier in the year, I attended a seminar where I was approached by Insurance News, who asked if they could interview me for a profile piece, which then subsequently appeared in the April-May issue of the magazine this year. It goes back to what I was saying earlier, people need to feel they know you. Another important aspect of presenting to boards is learning how to focus the key implications of one's analysis. When I carried out statutory actuarial roles, boards are presented to ask questions which help me improve my presentation next time. And these boards often had useful suggestions on clarifying aspects of my reports, for which I was always grateful. Boards want to know the key findings of your analysis, not just the answer. They want you to highlight key issues arising from the analysis or investigation, whatever the topic, that may impact strategy and risk. Boards also like clear answers to their questions. And every time I'm saying boards here, it could be management or your boss, and you could just substitute that for the exact, that would be the same thing. Your boss wants clear answers to their questions. They want to know what you learnt in your investigation, what surprised you, and what it means for the business. My experience in gaining a seat at the boardroom table shows me it very much relies on your network, particularly your current clients and colleagues. Additionally, boards have a skills matrix, which tells them the skills they're looking for in their next director. They also have a board renewal policy, and the company keeps a lookout for potential non-executive directors who fulfil their requirements. They then try to match the skills required of potential new director availability with the timing of directors rotating off. There are a number of areas where I think actuaries might contribute to being on a board. Firstly, they have deep and wide knowledge of their specialist industry, knowing what has and hasn't worked over the years, for example, over different countries, different business lines, different distribution channels. Secondly, linkage of capital and risk, what prudential capital requirements mean for frontline people. Thirdly, understanding implications of analysis and what it means for the business going forward. Fourthly, a different way of thinking about issues. why discussion in the boardroom leads to effective board decision-making, as opposed to everyone thinking the same. When one of my fellow non-executive directors asks management a very good question in a board meeting, I sometimes think, I should have thought of that. But that's the value of a diverse board. I won't think of every question. The whole idea of a diverse board is that different aspects of an issue are discussed rather than all board members thinking the same way. I have been fortunate to have been selected to participate in a mentoring program being run by the AICD to support women being appointed to boards to increase diversity. Companies are much more aware of their gender balance at different levels. I have attended a couple of AICD governance summits where there were a number of excellent keynote speakers. So women are starting to become a bit more visible, which is a good thing. One talk I particularly remember was from a David Jones board member during its tumultuous time a few years ago. When this non-executive director was new to the board, the CEO left, the chairman left, and several directors left. Only she and another new director remained, where they couldn't believe what had just happened and could either themselves resign or find a way forward for the company, which they did. She said they were meeting almost every day as they progressively found a new CEO, a new chair, and the story ends well for David Jones shareholders as they found a purchaser for the retailer in Woolworths, South Africa. Funny, I just tried to find her name, but I couldn't easily find a David Jones annual report. Their website is all about retail. You would think that listed companies would always have their annual report easy to find on the website. So she shall remain unidentified, but she gave a great talk. Before I conclude, I want to talk about discussions in the boardroom. Sometimes board papers receive no discussion in the boardroom, but that should not be seen by management as a win, since unless the item's very minor, ideally one wants some value add from the board. If the paper's difficult to follow, it might mean that discussion in the boardroom is around clarifying what it says and what are the implications, which means the directors haven't had the opportunity to think about it carefully and add value. The whole idea of a diverse, value-adding board is to encourage a wider discussion. Conclusion, what is valuable? In conclusion, I think there are six things that I think help me develop my soft skills and can develop yours. One, being in client and team meetings. Two, being on institute committees and task forces. Three, presenting at seminars. Four, your personal network. And five, being on the other side of the boardroom table. And this could really mean in management meetings, team meetings, that's where really where you start and it builds up. But there is no conventional path to the boardroom or to a senior role. Each individual should feel empowered about their own course, knowing they have the benefit of actuarial training behind them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Elaine, for a most interesting and inspiring speech. I know it's aimed at young people, but I got a few insights from it myself, so thank you. Now's the question time, so who would like to ask the first question of Elaine? There's a mic.
Hi, Elaine. Thanks for that presentation today. I really learned a lot. So I want to touch on one thing that you mentioned, which I thought was key, was the ability to explain technical information to non-technical people. So the standard actuarial pathway might be you first start off as an actuarial analyst and you're really among a lot of people who speak in an actuarial way. It's not perhaps until you rise up to management where you'll be reaching out to various parts of the business. So I want to ask the question, what would be kind of the best way to kind of learn how to explain technical information to non-technical person or to people at a younger point in their career?
That's a good question. I find if you, whatever analysis you do, if you think about the key things, what were the key things? Was it bigger than last time or less than last time? And if it was bigger than last time, what was the reason for it being bigger than last time? Ah, we started writing business in Western Australia. That's why it's bigger. So I think if you, it starts with the key implications of your analysis. So your answer is 5464.46. That's the answer. But when you got 5464.46, what surprised you? What did you discover when you got that answer? That's, I think that's what it is. It's about the key implications. What was a, what was,
what are the things you learnt when you did that analysis? And that's completely non-numeric. That's really your insights. And then I think if you explain your insights in short sentences to someone who's non-technical, I know when you're talking about when you get to management, you're more likely to talk to people who aren't technical, but I think even the actuarial area, as soon as you step out of the actuarial area to an underwriter or a claims person, other frontline people, an admin person, they're not always that technical. And I don't know if you get an opportunity to be in meetings with people, but if you are in any meetings with non-technical people, I think I just really keep coming back to those key insights. If you've got the key insights, that is really non-technical. That is usually three clear points, very short sentences, what you found. And it's only when you have to explain why you found those that you get more technical, and then I think it's okay to do that.
Thank you. Any other questions? We have another 12 minutes for questions. So.
Thanks, Elaine, for your talk. It was great. So I've just got a question on when we do FCRs and present them to boards, we're expected to comment on the risk management framework of the company. And I've always felt that somewhat underqualified in terms of doing that. And I'd be interested in your perspectives as a director in how well we do this, and whether the training provided to us as actuaries equips us to do that job well.
That is a good question. To be perfectly honest, our main focus when we look at the FCR is profitability, capital management, underwriting. It's not the risk management framework, the actuaries' comments risk management framework, unless they're very adverse, because we get. We have work and we hear a lot from the CRO on the risk management framework. So it's more a summary in the FCR. Having said that, the actuary will normally point out some key aspects of the risk management framework. I don't know, for example, it's the material may not be well linked together, the risk management framework's not well linked to the risk management strategy, those sorts of things. So it's more those high-level comments. It's more around risk culture, I think. To me, as a board, the most useful part in the FCR and risk management, I think, would be around the implications of risk culture, the implications of risk culture of the organisation from the risk management framework that exists in the company. And I don't think actuaries are underqualified to comment on that. I think actuaries get a very good feeling for how business is able to operate within limits based on how that's laid out to them. And I think actuaries are good at that. So I don't think actuaries should feel underqualified at all. But I think actuaries, it would be valuable if actuaries focused on the aspects for risk culture around the framework rather than going into any detail, because we've seen detail in other forums. Yeah.
Any other over there? Thank you.
Hi, Elaine. It's Alex here. I used to work with you before. I've got a question regarding formats for board papers and formats in general for presenting things. So in the past at Deloitte, we had presentations, and we also had Word documents. And board papers, I understand a paper usually is a Word document or something along those lines. But more recently, working with different people, I've seen the use of, and with other consultants, the increasing use of PowerPoint presentations. And I guess that brings out the key points, as you suggest. But I was wondering what your view is as a board member on those different formats and the pros and cons of each.
We normally see our board papers in Word format. Personally, I'm fine with presentation format for presentations because it's like five key points and that's it. But I know I saw it at Deloitte, some service lines wrote entire reports in presentation format, and it's crazily inefficient because if you start to go over a page, you have to move everything. It doesn't move it automatically for you. You've got to take that section and put it on a new page. Like, PowerPoint's not set up to be very wordy. It's only set up to be punchy. My view is that I prefer a board paper in a Word document because I want to understand what the what the objective of the paper is, and I think that's difficult in a PowerPoint, because usually, to me, a PowerPoint is more, there's five key points, and then someone will explain what the implications are or how they got to those five key points. With a board paper, there's no one to explain. The paper's there, management will take the paper as read, and then there'll be discussion in the boardroom. So my preference is for a Word document, but when I say that, I like it clear, concise. All those five, those 10 points. If a Word document follows those 10 things that I said on that slide, I'd be delighted with it. But I feel that a PowerPoint is not going to give the board enough information around the rationale for that. PowerPoints are usually given to us when we're going to have a workshop or where, so when there's a workshop and someone's presenting, that's where we get PowerPoints. Otherwise, we get Word documents. So yes, I think Word documents. But then again, things need to be precise and clear and rationale for the proposal and things that management has already thought of that needs to, things that management already thought of that needs to, that we need to think about, and then we can provide our evaluating insights. So that's really, so I think a Word document with some, because we've got to get a lot of background information usually. So a Word document gives us a lot of background information for what management is proposing to us.
So just to put that another way, are you saying basically Word documents are good in a summarised form when you don't get the chance to actually present it, but PowerPoint's when you get to present it?
I think so, but in a board meeting, the idea is not for management to present anything. So a workshop management will present something, but a board meeting is for the board to discuss the papers that are in front of them. So, and they're going to get a week to look at the papers, and they're going to come in with their questions and comments. And, you know, in my view, management shouldn't talk for more than 5 minutes at a board meeting because the paper's taken as read, the directors have read it, management might want to just highlight some key things or maybe highlight something in the last week that's changed since the board papers went out, and then it's open to discussion by the directors.
Thank
so
you.
That, yeah.
Thanks.
Any more, one more question there?
So obviously at a board level, you won't be able to see the nitty-gritty of what management are doing, what how they come up with a lot of their day-to-day decisions. But your slide about HIH made me think of this, and your comment about a lot of things have changed in what boards can allow management to do. So thinking about risk culture, the true culture, I think, comes out under stress, when things go wrong. What would you say are some warning signs to you as a director when the of how you might identify that the culture is changing or that things are starting to go wrong and that management might not be giving you the full picture of what you need to know?
Yes, that is a good question, because we do try to set up structures so that we will get the full picture of what's going on. But, you know, there's kind of key things to look out for. High turnover is a good indication that risk culture is not as it should be in the organisation. Big changes in financials. You know, theoretically, financials should be progressing as we expect, and we've got a plan. We might know the risks to the plan, and if financials are moving in the direction of we thought that was going to be a risk, so things aren't as good as we thought. It's around meeting plan or not meeting plan and the reasons for it. People turnover. Board papers coming in a poorly structured way. Things where it looks like people aren't working together well. Management aren't working together well. They're very, this hasn't happened to me, but I'm just trying to think of ideas. It would be when, you know, if management aren't aligned in their thinking, the papers are going to not be consistent with each other. That's something I could think. So I guess those three things are all I can think of at the top of my head. The only one I've come across in my actual history has been high turnover, but I thought those other two are probably would be contributing to something that I would be concerned about.
Did HIH exhibit those things,
well,
like high turnover?
I don't know, because I was a very young actuary in those days, and HIH, from what when we were doing the liquidation work for HIH, it was clear that, you know, going to film industry. I mean, insurers getting into insuring films, you know, and then we didn't think they knew anything about films. They don't know data analytics or anything. I don't know how they even got their price. So we found all sorts of business that are writing all over the place, and it didn't look like they'd done any analytics at all. They just collected the premium and moved on. So that's, you know, kind of how we saw it. So I don't know what papers actually got to the board but what I could see, they were getting a lot of information on entering the film industry, for example.
Mm. Okay, does anyone have one last pressing question? We've got a couple of minutes. No? Okay, well, let's close here. Thank you very much, Elaine.
Well, most fantastic speech.